Hello and welcome to the Independence Journal. I'm your host, Avery Klauber. On today's program, my co-host Valerie Lewis will be discussing critical issues of dealing with disasters. How can people with disabilities handle natural and man-made disasters? How do you develop a plan of action to survive hurricanes, blizzards, and floods? And how can people with disabilities be assured that they will never be left behind when disaster strikes? Coming up next. And since 1997, the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund has been dedicated to protecting and advancing civil rights of people with disabilities through legislation, litigation, advocacy, and education. How far has the disability rights movement gone, and where does it stand now? Learning to know your rights today on the Independence Journal.
This is Valerie Lewis with the Independence Journal, and I am speaking today with Linda Carter. Linda is the founder and director of No Person Left Behind, and Linda is going to explain to us what her organization does and how it is helpful to people with disabilities in an emergency situation, which is apropos for today, September 11th, creates a lot of memories for me in particular, because I know that in many emergency situations that emergency preparedness is invaluable. Most emergency evacuation sites are not accessible to people with disabilities, and I think this is where Linda's organization comes in such a valuable way. So Linda, if you can explain to us what you do there down in South Florida, I think people would be very interested to learn about it.
Thank you, Valerie. No Person Left Behind is a easy program to work with and understand because it was designed by people with disabilities, for people with disabilities, run by people with disabilities, and it's designed to help people with disabilities understand how to prepare for a disaster. One of the things that emergency situations, people with disabilities are not informed as to what to do and where to go and to do it. So our organization has four major goals. The first goal is accountability. We want to know where you're at, what type of disability you have. We want to identify your needs. Are you in a wheelchair? Are you visually impaired? Are you hearing impaired? Because if you stay at home and something happens, somebody needs to know where you're at to bring the right resources to help you.
Absolutely.
The third one is education. We provide education through the Federal Emergency Management Agency, otherwise known as FEMA, to provide free information in Braille, audio tape, and in large print, or in normal print to people, so that you can be prepared and educated just like the rest of the public. And the final one, which is the most important goal, is we empower persons with disabilities to take control of their disaster plan. The nation is not going to come out and say, here, what can we do to help you? You need to have a plan so that for the first 3 days, you know what you're going to do. And then when they start announcing, you know, who needs help, you're able to give them that information.
That's right. I mean, just like anyone else is encouraged to have a plan in the case of a disaster, people with disabilities should follow those same kinds of guidelines.
And we've written a guideline for people with disabilities because people with disabilities normally need an extra 2 to 3 months to prepare ahead of time, because if you're a mobility impaired, you have to have extra batteries. You have to, and we're all on limited income, so we have to prepare for this planning on a year-round basis, because it may be a flood, it could be rain, it could be snow, a fire, it could be any type. So this plan, once you design it, is a year-round document to help you and empower you to take control of your disaster.
Okay. So when people, so the first step of this in terms of accountability, people need to then contact your organization or a central site.
They register online at nopersonleftbehind.org. They fill out an online form, which is then inputted into our database, and they are then identified with their needs, and then we mail them educational material.
Okay. And then the second step after accountability
is identify their basic needs.
So on the online form, then people will have a place to put information about what their individual needs are in regard to their disability.
Correct. If they're visually impaired, if they use TTY, if they use any type of other devices, mobility, or have a service dog, whatever the case may be, they will be able to add this information on the online form.
Okay. Then the third step again?
Is educate the persons with disabilities and their families on disaster preparedness.
So that part would be where you have the materials from FEMA, and you can then provide these materials to an individual who has registered at the website.
Correct.
And you will mail these materials to their home.
Yes, yes, we do.
Okay. And then the fourth step again?
We empower them to take control of their disaster plan.
Okay. So it's really a four-step process where people can voluntarily register in a database so that they will receive emergency preparedness materials. Now, in the event of an emergency, they will then be contacted in a format that they can use to let them know about the emergency, or how does something like that play out?
We're set up with a voice over internet database call system that once an emergency has been declared by the county commissioners, or depending on where you're located, we then make a notification call 72 hours out telling them, you need to be prepared, here's what's going on, and if you have a question, who to call. This way they can make sure that their neighbor who they have as their primary transportation, or somebody they're going to say they're going to go stay with, is there.
Okay, that's wonderful. So you work in conjunction with the individual, you've created a plan already in advance, and this eliminates the incident where someone has nowhere to go.
Correct, because out of an emergency planning, in their disaster plan, they have four options. And those four options, the first one is stay at home. But if you stay at home, you need to make sure you follow the guidelines in your disaster plan.
Mm-hmm.
Option B is stay with a friend, relatives, or a hotel outside the evacuation area. Most of our people with disabilities don't drive.
Right.
So that means we're limited in what we can do with option B. Option C is relocate out of the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then option D is go to a public shelter.
Okay.
And
now, I know a problem with a lot of public shelters across the country, places that have been chosen as public shelters, often are not accessible to people with physical disabilities, people with visual impairments, people with hearing impairments. I've understood recently that the American Red Cross, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I'm not sure of the access they have to sign language interpreters or how well-versed they are in terms of communicating with a person who has a disability.
One of the things that we are doing with our local Red Cross here in Lee County in Southwest Florida is that we're working hand-to-hand so that when we have people with disabilities go into the shelters, they can also help work with other people, you know, that are coming in. So it's a partnership that it have people with disabilities helping people with disabilities.
Well, that's
because we're the ones that know what our needs are.
That's right. That is absolutely right. So you are working, I suspect that you are working with a variety of agencies in South Florida in terms of educating these various agencies in the event of these emergencies.
Correct.
And what types of agencies are you working with?
We are working with the local sheriff's department, the police departments, the emergency management agencies, the fire departments, Red Cross, other nonprofit disability groups throughout the entire state.
That's excellent. And then that would be part of the whole program that can be replicated throughout the country for ADA advisory committees, different types of offices for handicapped services, can reach out to these other emergency management agencies in their areas and educate them and then work cooperatively with them to educate their members and then you know, subsequently provide these materials in alternative formats for people
Correct.
With disabilities. Well, that's an incredible resource to have. And
there's one resource that we overlooked,
okay.
which is one of the most important after we've done all of this, because of the fact, if we look at what happened in New Orleans and other major areas of disaster, when people were transferred out of these areas, people didn't know where they were sent to.
That's right.
Now, if we have people in the New York area register, they would be into our master nationwide database.
Uh-huh.
So if they were transferred out of that area to New York or to Ohio or to Florida, we would know where they were sent to if they were logged in.
That is incredible.
If that agency would log them in, same way in Florida, if they were relocated out of an area, we would know in real time where people were at, and the people would then be able to be given a number to call and update the database so people could find them in real time, not 8 months later.
Well, that's probably the most important piece of information that we need. So let us know, let our listeners know, how they can contact you, how to reach your organization, and how to learn more about your organization.
You can find us on nopersonleftbehind.org on the internet. And my email address is mslindacarter@comcast.net. All of the information that we've discussed today is on the internet at nopersonleftbehind.org.
That is an incredible resource. We are so pleased to have spoken with you today on September 11th, a day which reminds us how important it is to always be prepared for any type of emergency situation. Thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you, Valerie.
I'd like to welcome my guest, Marilyn Golden, a policy analyst for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Thank you for being on the Independence Journal with us, Marilyn.
My pleasure.
If you could tell our listeners a little bit about what the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund is and how it got started and some of the areas that it covers.
The Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, or DREDF, our acronym, DREDF, is a national law and policy center exclusively devoted to the issue of disability civil rights. We are the only national law and policy center on disability rights that has such a strong component in terms of policy development. We began in 1979, and we have four major activities: policy development on a federal level, training, technical assistance, and then, when necessary, litigation. And that's an overall summary of DREDF. We were begun by people with disabilities and parents of children with disabilities to address the rampant, at that time, rampant discrimination still present in American life. And since then, we have worked on our policy development activities, have included many successes. We've worked on several reauthorizations of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We did a lot of work on the development of the Fair Housing Amendments Act, and especially on the Americans with Disabilities Act, among other laws. Policy development, by that I mean working on developing the civil rights laws and regulations that protect people with disabilities from discrimination in this country. So working on the development of, and then the development of the regulations of, for example, the Americans with Disabilities Act.
I see. I understand that you have special expertise in transportation issues. What is the current state of affairs regarding transportation for people with disabilities?
I focus especially on the area of ADA transportation under the Americans with Disabilities Act. There has been huge improvements under the ADA, but as in just about every ADA area, a great deal remains to be done. We have a lot more accessible buses, a lot more paratransit, complementary paratransit under the ADA. We have more access to Greyhound buses and to, for example, cruise ships, to the train. We have improved access to Amtrak. We have a lot more subways and streetcar lines in the U.S. that are accessible. But there are still many problems with a lot of these services. For example, in terms of the city buses, there are still sometimes problems getting a driver to stop for a person with a disability. There are still many problems getting the stops called in compliance with the ADA. Mm-hmm. There are many problems related to complementary ADA paratransit in terms of on-time performance, in terms of trips being denied, in terms of rides taking too long. And so we continue to work on these issues to try to improve them. We've worked a lot lately, for example, with the Federal Transit Administration, with DOT, the U.S. Department of Transportation, mm-hmm. Which has put out some better policies under the ADA. And those policies have been in some ways resisted by the transit industry. So it's an ongoing struggle to get better transportation.
Using transportation is perhaps an example, because I think those are issues which affect, I think, most people with certainly most people with physical disabilities, but people with disabilities in general. How do you try to apply the legal system in trying to better facilitate transportation access for people with disabilities?
We have done some litigation on transportation. Okay. We have not been a big transportation litigator. We have worked with a lot of other communities in terms of assisting them and what they're doing. We have actually had some projects with Amtrak and with some paratransit systems in California. But most of our transportation work has been policy work. We've worked a lot on the development of the regulations, for example, to make sure that they stay strong. We, for example, did a lot of work to make sure the regulations that came out in 1998 under the ADA that covered Greyhound and other companies, private companies that use over-the-road buses, high-floor buses with a baggage compartment underneath, that those companies were required to buy new buses, accessible buses, when they bought new buses, and to make sure those lifts were maintained. A good example is what's happened with Greyhound Lines, Inc., which was an organization, a company that had actually resisted accessibility for many years and had been targeted by many demonstrations. But under the strong regulation the Department of Transportation put out, Greyhound got itself a good ADA coordinator and actually has complied with it very well and, really is a model in ADA compliance.
I would imagine that goes right to the bottom line also, because it gives them more flexibility. They have more opportunity to have people with disabilities riding on their buses.
We certainly hope so. I mean, I don't know if there's been a study on the return, and we always look to the market power of the disability community, and we hope that businesses will know that access is a good investment. But regardless of what the numbers are, we have seen efforts by them that are commendable. For example, I was at a meeting recently with their ADA coordinator, who told me that this is just one example of something that they do that we think is a good practice. They have, of course, a brochure talking about their services for people with disabilities, as many transit companies do. They have that brochure in poster form, and every Greyhound station is required to have that poster up. That brochure and that poster say, if you're not being given the services that you are guaranteed, call this number. And the number goes right to Greyhound's ADA coordinator. And so that's how he finds out sometimes what the problems are in his own organization. I don't know any public transit, if Greyhound is a private company, I don't know any public transit organization that posts the ADA rules on their buses, for example. So this posting that they do at their stations is really an example of a practice that isn't required by the ADA, but is very much in the spirit of the ADA because it helps Greyhound reach full ADA implementation successfully.
I think that's, that might be emblematic of all kinds of different sectors of the society, access to to stores and supermarkets and restaurants and medical facilities and places like that, because not only do we have roughly 54 million people with disabilities in the country currently, which is a fairly large demographic, though not all people have mobility issues, but certainly as the baby boomers start getting older and start dealing with these issues, you're going to have a tremendous rise in the needs for accessibility in all sectors of the society.
Amen to that.
So laying the groundwork here is just going to make life a whole lot easier for people like me, for example, who will be a doddering old man very soon. In terms of one of the other things that I noticed that the organization is involved with is accessible voting, which I know that my co-host has a great stake in, because she is legally blind and has a difficult time in pursuit of her rights as a voter. And how have things gone at this point?
You've asked a huge question, because
I try.
Because Dredf, of course, works in at many levels in terms of federal, in terms of state. In particular, Dredf has been involved at the state level in California in working on accessible voting machines. There has been a lot of activities federally as well. I think it's a long-term struggle very much in terms of accessible voting.
I think here in New York there's a lot of foot dragging. It's my impression, without having entirely clear knowledge of what's going on. I believe that they're trying to provide some kind of accessibility in terms of voting in every polling place. At this point in time, I'm not entirely sure to what degree that is succeeding or not. So we're not entirely sure what shape we might be in come November.
Certainly, no. We hope in California we're in better shape than we were before. There have been some very monumental movings forward in many jurisdictions to get accessible voting machines, and I think this is going to be one of the ones of a road on which there are many steps, may we say.
Yeah. What have, in terms of some of the other areas that the organization has been involved with, what have been some of the more recent highlights that you might be able to discuss as in terms of dealing with the ADA or dealing with education?
We do a lot of work on education. Dredf is a designated parent training and information center.
Mm-hmm.
Dredf helps parents of children with disabilities secure educational and related services under state and federal law in our region of California. We also monitor implementation and compliance nationally with those laws, with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We work on shaping education public policy and representing children with disabilities in the educational reform debate. So our parents unit is very active, and they're doing a lot of training. They're doing
a lot of work.
These
are parents that you help to become advocates for their own children?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And trainings that are offered for those parents.
Now, do you do this just in California, or can people...
We are parent training and information center specifically in our region of California.
Gotcha. But there would be others who that people might be able to contact locally, or
in
their region of the country. Okay.
Yes.
And so.
Go ahead.
No, and you know, so that you basically help parents to be able to advocate for their children, so that they get the kind of education plan that their individual child would need in order to get their education.
And I'll just give you an example of one of our areas of special focus. One ongoing project in our education unit, which are, I should say, our Children and Family Advocacy Program, is the critical failure to enforce education rights of foster youth in California, foster children. 45 to 60% of foster children have disabilities. But even so, youth with disabilities in the child welfare system are far less likely than other children to secure the services that they need through their critical years in elementary and secondary school. And, of course, they have lifelong adverse effects from this. Foster youth often lack a consistent caregiver, and they require that the court appoint a surrogate to act on their behalf. So their efforts to get good services are much more complicated. We have advocates who focus intensively on the problems of children in the foster care system. They train county social service professionals, foster parents, older youth in the child welfare system so that they all understand the children's rights and know about the community resources that are available to them. We're also working to enforce and protect rights in the California foster system for youth who need special education and often become dependents on the court. We have a center, the Foster Children with Disabilities Resource Center. We have some specialized grants for that from the Van Lobenzels Rembrock and the Morris Stoltzaff Foundations, and we're seeking additional funding. That center provides training on IDEA, the law that I had mentioned, on parts of that law, including the individual education plans. We work, of course, on Section 504, which have other rights. California laws have particular rights.
That when federal money is involved, Section 504 is involved?
That's right. It covers, and for example, the schools. The schools get federal money, and so have a lot of responsibilities under Section 504. And there's work in the due process activities under IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, mediation activities. There's two big activities lately were a big training program in our county for social service professionals and dependency attorneys and probation officers and service providers of all kinds. We have also a no-cost technical assistance and legal support program for trainees. And we're looking forward to additional funding that will allow us to produce a curriculum for public welfare agencies of materials and presentations specifically aimed at foster children with disabilities.
Well, it looks on that note, I have to say that our time is just about up, and I would like if you can tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and find out more about your very vital organization.
Thank you very much. Our home office is in Berkeley, California. Our number is 510-644-2555. Our website is at dredf.org. That's D-R-E-D-F as in Frank, DISEducation.org, standing for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund.org, where you can find out more about all of our programs.
Marilyn Golden, a policy analyst for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund.
We would like to thank our guests and thank you for listening. If you missed any part of today's show, or if you have any questions, please go to our website at www.disabilityresources.org. My co-host is Valerie Lewis. The Independence Journal is produced by Disability Resources, and I'm Avery Klauber.